the truth, they should think very seriously about putting out documents, because nothing else will convince the public adequately that the president is lying when he is.
That's a very, very good point. It's they have such concrete proof, and that's would.
It's not easy to, and maybe that's, I don't know. Too much benefit of the doubt is given to the president. Our system is not based on that kind of faith. That's why we have three branches of government with overlapping but separate powers. It's why we have an impeachment clause. It's why the power of going to war is supposedly intended to be given to Congress, not to the president. And that's been eroded terribly, including one can almost say most blatantly in some ways by this president in going to war against Iraq. But in this case, actually, he did go ahead on the basis of lies and get agreement from the Congress to, they in effect delegated their constitutional power to go to war to the president. And really, they should be held accountable for that. They are responsible for it. It was irresponsible. They knew what the president was going to do with this. They can say they were lied to, and they were. But realistically, I'm not sure those lies were necessary. They didn't want to take responsibility away from the president, as the Constitution tells them to do. They didn't want to exercise that responsibility against the wishes of a popular president, and they irresponsibly signed that over to him. Still, I hope that they rise to their error on that and pursue this the lying that was done to them.
One of my hopes is that in this age of the internet and copy machines and fax machines and so forth and so on, is that we have a better chance to refute these lies. And certainly an epic book like yours will go a long ways towards turning that around. I'm just hoping we're building up more and more momentum towards exposing.
Something much better than a fax machine now. I mean, I had to deal with Xeroxing 7,000 pages by myself and then getting it to a publication. A fax machine would have made that better, but the real advance here now, of course, is the internet. And the possibility, if I'd had that available to me, I don't know if I would have gone to the New York Times. I would have scanned that information into the internet and put it out. And that's a capability. I hope that we'll move against wrongful government secrecy. Now, as we're seeing right now, there are secrets where the government is justified in keeping. I would guess from my experience, which is pretty extensive on this point, that it's something much less than a fraction of 1% of the pages that are actually stamped secret and top secret and otherwise. In other words, the vast majority of that does not deserve protection from the public or anybody, in particular more than days or weeks. In some cases you can make a case. But we're talking about information now that routinely stays classified for decades.
Well, one of the rumors I've heard is that there's still classified papers about the Lincoln assassination, and I've been trying to find...
That could well be. I do believe, I have read, that there is information from the Civil War, which is what you're talking about, that is still classified, supposed intelligence sources and methods and so forth that they don't want out. There's certainly a lot of information from World War I and a vast amount from World War II that's still classified. And as I was mentioning earlier, crucial information about what the president knew, what the government knew about preceding Pearl Harbor, about a possible attack on Pearl Harbor, was certainly available to the government, whether or not it was fully made available to the president before Pearl Harbor, and we didn't know about that till the last few years, 50 years after the event.
Well, it's amazing. Even this business about John F. Kennedy, you're talking about the assassination of the president of South Vietnam. There's been a few articles lately claiming that John F. Kennedy was murdered by a combination of the French mafia and people from South Vietnam wanting revenge. It's one of the latest conspiracy theories on JFK.
Well, again, that's... Now, here you have a case at any rate where there has been, over time, a very great release of information thanks to action of Congress. Information doesn't probably solve the thing, and no doubt crucial parts are still being withheld, but here's a case where Congress did ultimately demand, by law, a great release of information that wouldn't have gotten out otherwise, and that's what they should be doing about these other matters. By the way, as I look at my book, maybe I'll quote this tomorrow, I see a quote that I transcribed from the President. This is President Nixon to, I'm sure that White House tapes of this President, and I'd be glad to know that there are tapes of the Oval Office right now and that we would eventually get them, the sooner the better, as in the Nixon case, where, by the way, we still haven't gotten most of the tapes 30 years later. But what we have is quite interesting. And here's one just a week or so after the...
Mr. Ellsberg, we have only 30 seconds left.
All right.
So maybe...
Nixon to Mitchell on Daniel Ellsberg. We've got to get him. Don't worry about his trial. Just get everything out. Try him in the press. Everything, John, there is on the investigation, get it out. Leak it out. We want to destroy him in the press. Press. Is that clear? Yes, says Kissinger and Mitchell. That's the conversation that went on before the name of Joseph Wilson's wife was put out to the Sun-Times.
Well, folks, get in your car, one of those car-polluting vehicles, and head down to Rio Theater, Daniel Ellsberg, tomorrow night.
Okay. Thanks for having me on.
That was close.
Okay, Wilson.
This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us in the studio Brian Adamson, and we're going to be talking about some videos that are going to be shown in the next hour here in the Monterey Bay area over local cable television. And, of course, so these are videos. Well, the first one we're going to talk about is something that our guest has worked on for a long period of time, and this is video dealing with George de Morenschild. Now, most people don't know who de Morenschild was, but he was a very important character in the assassination of Lee Harvey Oswald, the assassination of John Kennedy. He was Lee Harvey Oswald's closest friend. George de Morenschild also had very close connections to George Herbert Walker Bush and Allen Dulles and Lyndon Baines Johnson and the CIA. But what had happened is that Brian had actually gone and
Bruce,
had, Bruce Adamson had actually gone, and he'd gotten hold of Des Moines Celts, actually a telephone book. He carried a telephone book. Well, Bruce, why don't you go ahead and tell the story of how you gathered this information about Des Moines Celt, Lee Harvey Oswald's mentor?
Well, I just got sick of the subject, and now I started in 92, and I've invested over $160,000, and I just started making connections as a genealogist. I've been a genealogist since...
You're going to have to get that microphone up fairly close to you.
I've been a genealogist since 1982, and as a genealogist, I have a different technique of doing research, unlike like law enforcement agencies. But it's like a law enforcement agency because you're doing history research and you have to pull people together, not to what you want the conclusion to be, but by the conclusions you find. And it's like kind of like looking through a microscope back in time, and you're seeing all these causes and effects.
All right. Well, now, you actually went down to Florida, where Des Moines Celt lived at the time he died, and you got hold of his telephone book, his telephone directory?
Yes. I contacted the colonel, Colonel Sheets at the West Palm Beach Sheriff's Office, and I told him, you don't have the time. I didn't tell him. I asked him. I said, you don't have the time to do this kind of research. If you give me a copy of Des Moines Celt's phone book as a genealogist, I'll do the research and I'll let you know what I find out. And that was back in 92. And then
this was almost 30 years after the assassinations.
Yeah, it was 30 years. This year is the 40th year of the assassination, and I started making a lot of interesting connections to the rich and the famous, from Lee Harvey Oswald's best friend, and also that I can prove that he was a CIA agent at the time.
And so here is the man who is mentoring Lee Harvey Oswald as a CIA agent. Now, you put this all into a video, and that's the one that's going to be shown this next hour
on
local cable television?
Yes, it'll be on Channel 27 on Santa Cruz Community TV, and it's free, there's a lot of information, and somebody that's not really familiar with the subject, they want to just tape it and then watch it a couple times, and then they will be able to see the importance. I am not the greatest narrator. I produced another video immediately following that one, and I had Professor Steve Hanley at Cabrillo College help me with the writing on that, and then it's narrated by Wes Sims, and I worked on that video for 2 years, and that one actually came out a lot better, but it's not my talent that makes it so good. Had I had Wes Sims for the narration of George Bush, I think it would have came out a lot better.
Oh, you're speaking of George Bush, you're speaking of George Herbert Walker Bush.
Right.
Who was tied in.
Right. Thanks,
George Herbert Walker Bush. Most people have forgotten that he had been in the CIA for many years, ended up as the director of the CIA, and then shortly after that, in a short term in Congress, why he is elected vice president of the United States for 8 years, and then the president for 4 more years. So he actually really controlled the White House for a period of 12 years between 1980 and, of course, 1992, when he was voted out of office, 1993. What's really so interesting, of course, is that here's a man who was the head of the CIA, suddenly is the president of the United States, sort of like it is in Russia, where the head of the KGB becomes the president or the dictator of Russia.
And he wrote me a letter in 93 admitting that he knew Lee Harvey Oswald's best friend since 1942. Well, I was circumstantially able to prove that George Herbert Walker Bush was in charge of the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was codenamed Operation Zapata.
And isn't that his oil company?
It was not through Zapata Oil. It was through another oil company, Permago Oil Company, which he was partners with the Democratic chairman, Edwin Pauley of California. He was, they were in business in Mexico City, which was a really, in reality, a front for the CIA for the Bay of Pigs. And then here he is knowing Lee Harvey Oswald's best friend, and his dad is very good friends with Prescott Bush at Harriman and Brown Brothers. And Harriman and Brown Brothers, or Brown Brothers and Harriman, gave DeMornschild a $300,000 line of credit 3 days before DeMornschild meets with Lyndon Johnson for a second time, Vice President Lyndon Johnson. And I found these letters between Lyndon Johnson and DeMornschild 7 months before the assassination. So why would the Vice President be meeting Lee Harvey Oswald's best friend? And they sure weren't a part of the Warren Commission report.
And, of course, you actually found those at Lyndon Johnson's library in Texas, right? So Bruce is actually has a motorhome, and he travels all over the country gathering the information, then puts it together, and it is available not only in this video, but you have some books. How can people get those books?
Well, they can get it through the Radio Liberty website, or they can buy the all 14 books on the CD, and those are digitally mastered. They just have to sign a pledge, and but the digitally mastered books on CD, there's 14 volumes total. So there's one or two that deal with Bush's involvement. There's one with Lyndon Johnson, Alan Dulles, Henry Luce. But it's a hard sell and a hard story to tell in, you know, an hour or 30 minutes, you know.
It's the 10 years of your life that you put into this research. And these amazing, amazing connections between the CIA and Lee Harvey Oswald, DeMornschild, and then, of course, this web of people that DeMornschild is working with. This is the other thing that points directly to the Central Intelligence Agency's knowledge. And, of course, there's no way that this could have been done and covered up without, of course, the CIA and the FBI both being involved. Otherwise, of course, you know, the sequence, you know, here Lee Harvey Oswald supposedly shoots at President Kennedy. He has a magic bullet that goes through President Kennedy and goes through Governor Connally and goes through Governor Connally's chest and his right wrist and his left thigh and leaves all sorts of bullet fragments, because I've talked to a doctor who was there when they, of course, debrided the wounds. They were all full of lead. And then the bullet magically reconstitutes itself and comes back to pristine condition that is found lying on the gurney next to Governor Connally in the emergency room at Parkland Hospital in Texas. And the fact that the American people would believe that Lee Harvey Oswald fired that shot is beyond our comprehension. And then, of course, Lee Harvey Oswald is promptly killed by Jack Ruby, who obviously is going to get caught. He knows he's going to get caught, so why does he kill Oswald? And all of these crazy explanations that Ruby gives, none of them are true, but he's afraid for his life and his family's life if he tells the truth about why he killed Lee Harvey Oswald. So basically, what is your conclusion after all this time and all this work you've done, Bruce?
Well, there are a number of motives, and, you know, it's hard to... I believe that that the Bay of Pigs was one of the motives. The firing of Alan Dulles was one motive.
He was the head of the CIA, and he was actually
in charge of the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was George Bush's operation.
And then, of course, he is put on the Warren Commission to conceal the truth, because he's already been fired by Kennedy. He hates Kennedy. If there's one man who had an excuse to kill Kennedy, it would be Alan Dulles, and they put him on the Warren Commission?
Yeah, I believe Alan Dulles was like one of the masterminds and in charge of the whole operation. But there are some other motives, the oil depletion allowance, and then George Herbert Walker Bush was introduced into politics by Ole Cassini's former wife.
Well, now, who's Ole Cassini? Because that's
Jackie
name
Kennedy's dress designer and friends with DeMornschild. And Ole Cassini's sister-in-law committed suicide because of Bobby Kennedy right when DeMornschild was hanging out with Oswald. And DeMornschild and the Cassinis and Jack Ruby are all white Russians. Jack Ruby was a Russian Jewish, but
now why? What's the relationship between Cassini's sister and Bobby Kennedy?
Bobby Kennedy, as Attorney General, was prosecuting DeMornschild's good friend Igor Cassini, whose father-in-law would put Lyndon Johnson up every time he visited Palm Beach, and Igor Cassini formed a corporation and he took in $150,000, but he didn't register with under the Registration Act. And so Bobby was forced into prosecuting him, and it was too much for Igor Cassini's wife, Charlene Reitzman, a Palm Beach lady of real wealth. Her grandfather was the author of the oil depletion allowance. And they kind of like all interconnect together.
Of course, there's the oil depletion allowance. The oil men certainly were furious with Kennedy because he was going to do away with this.
Reduce it or remove it.
And, of course, they could get a 25% write-off on whatever they were doing, and they didn't have to pay taxes on that. So when, of course, Kennedy's going to do that, at least some of these people are very furious with him.
Yes, and de Mornschild, as an oil geologist, had ties to every top oilman, George Brown, Herman Brown, H.L. Hunt, Clint Murchison or Murchison. He just knew all the top oilmen. George Herbert Walker Bush was running Zapata Oil throughout the 50s. Well, I can prove de Mornschild and Bush were CIA agents in the 50s. And de Mornschild's father-in-law was in charge of more than 250 CIA agents 10 years before the assassination, but they didn't tell us that when they published the Warren Commission report.
Well, of course, the thing is that all the ties to the CIA, to Mornschild, of course, the Bush family tied into the CIA. We never talk about that, but here's a man, long-term CIA agent. He runs Zapata Oil, the name of the Bay of Pigs invasion,
right.
Operation Zapata. In fact, wasn't one of the ships named Barbara?
The Barbara J. and the Houston,
right.
And Bush was the senior Houston CIA agent when Alan Dulles goes to meet the CIA shortly before he meets Neil Mallon 2 weeks before.
Now, who is Neil Mallon? Because our listeners wouldn't know who he is.
Well, he is the mentor of George Herbert Walker Bush. And he was the founder of the CIA's Dallas Council on World Affairs in 1951, but he was also president of Dressers Industries, which merged with Halliburton Oil in 1998.
Is that Halliburton?
Right.
Halliburton, that's the one that Dick Cheney was just was the CEO of. He'd spent all of his life in government. He leaves government in 1992 as Secretary of Defense, and suddenly he is the CEO of Halliburton Oil, where he works for 8 years, and then he goes from there into the vice presidency. But Halliburton continues paying him, not for work done, but as a deferred salary. So he's getting $150,000 a year from Halliburton. And then Halliburton gets all of these contracts from the government without a bid on them, worth billions of dollars for a work that nobody even knows what they're going to be doing, because they're going to repair the oil wells and the oil lines after after the attack on Iraq is over. Only there's no damage done at the time they signed the contract, and I think it was for $1.7 billion. And this, of course, gives incest a bad name.
Well, I can only, I try to keep my mind on, I can't keep up with everything that's going on, but there's just some things that that kind of fit together, and I try to tell the story, and I'm pleased that I'm able to tell a story on public access TV and put it together. I may not be the best and most creative speaker, but I'm happy with being able to tell the story, but my problem is there's so much information, and I think that anybody who views it will, you know, would want to tape it and watch it maybe once or twice, and they will pick up more than in the first passing.
And I really think that if you have the ability to tape it, and then you begin to learn what these names are, Neil Mallon and Igor Cassini, and then you begin seeing this web of control or this interrelationship between George de Mornschild and all of these key figures going into the Kennedy family and going into the Bush family, and of course going into the Johnsons, going into Alan Dulles.
I mean, he was friends with Cecil B. DeMille, Hal Roach. You know, this is Lee Harvey Oswald's best friend. Nelson Rockefeller. He worked for Nelson Rockefeller. William S. Paley.
Paley, of course, is the large oil man from California.
No, that would be Pauley.
Oh, right. Paley is the fellow from
CBS,
right?
Right, who admitted working with the CIA. And I noticed the story today about the CIA agent. Well, when Bush was accused in 1988 of being involved in this, being briefed by J. Edgar Hoover the day after the assassination, he broke the number one rule. He released the name of another George W. Bush, a low-level CIA clerk, that there was this other George W. Bush in on the East Coast.
But why would J. Edgar Hoover brief a low-level clerk about that?
Right, right, right. And
you know, you certainly would think that, you know, I wonder how many low-level clerks named George W. Bush would be briefed, you know, about the assassination of an American president.
The president's son, George Herbert Walker, his son is George W. Bush, too.
Right.
Right, so we don't know where he was some of the time. But there's a lot to the Des Moines Show story, and it was a lot of work, but I try to save people the time of having to travel all over the country and go through these mountains of folders of personal papers, whether it's Alan Dulles, Lyndon Johnson, George Crewe McGee, and make it easy. And, you know, if you can't tell a story in the networks, and people do not know about this person, then no one is ever able to fit in the missing pieces. So you need to be able to tell a story, and if you can't tell a story, then we're only human. We don't know everything, and it's takes a lot of time and patience to sit there and take this jigsaw puzzle and put it together. You don't force it in there. You just have to put it together, and if there's something out there that other people know, then and they're never able to have access to the information, then but this is really beyond discovery. I mean, it's fact, and it's really powerful when you think that Oswald's best friend's father-in-law was in charge of more than 250 CIA agents 10 years before the assassination. Why wouldn't they tell us that? I mean, there's no reason why they would. They should have told us that.
Well, of course, I think the last thing they really wanted was to suggest that maybe people affiliated with the CIA were very, very close to Lee Harvey Oswald, because then they might have looked into it and found, of course, he was working for both FBI and the CIA. And, of course, there's a great deal to suggest he was working with a military intelligence, one that his defection to the Soviet Union was as phony as a $3 bill. In fact, if you've never heard Craig Roberts' story of the two Lee Harvey Oswalds, a fascinating, fascinating insight into the intrigue that exists out there. And we're going to be back here in just a moment with Bruce Adamson. We're going to be talking about this video and another video that's going to be shown in this area later this evening. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Bruce Adamson. We're talking about the video that's going to be shown here in the Monterey Bay area on the next hour on Channel 27. Are they both going to be shown, both your videos, Bruce?
Yeah, they'll be back-to-back. First will be 1,000 Points of Light, George H.W. Bush and the JFK assassination. And the second one is Harold Adamson, An Affair to Remember, which has nothing to do with conspiracy. In fact, it's just a video that I spent about 2 years on, and I met, coincidentally, I met the president of Time Warner, Roger Mayer, who threatened me not to use the film clips of certain videos because Time Warner owned it, but he said he was going to do everything in his power to get this video produced, and then he never contacted me. Well, he just happened to be in the same class as George Herbert Walker Bush at Yale University. And here he is, the head of Time Warner. But
what was his name?
Roger Mayer.
Okay.
And not related to MGM Mayer's.
That's right.
Okay. And so anyway, I put all this work, 2 years, and my aunt drove me over there, who passed away last year. And my aunt was one of the most important people in my life. She was like a mom. So I said, well, I did all this work, and I'm not going to have it done in vain. And then a former deputy attorney general for the state of California, who's won 2 U.S. Supreme Court death penalty cases, reviewed it like about 5 times. And there's a thing called fair use that you're able to use film clips, 5, 10 seconds short clips of videos, if you're do for educational videos. So there's no profit on this, but I wanted to share the video, and it was a lot of work, and I just didn't want to, you know, I really wanted to see it successful for my aunt.
Okay, fine. So so you put this together, and who was this gentleman, and what did he do?
Well, Harold Adamson was nominated 5 times for Academy Award. He wrote, his biggest hit was I Love Lucy. And then he wrote the same year that Doris Day sung Que Sera Sera, he wrote Around the World in 80 Days for the film. But he wrote the words to with Victor Young, who composed the music for Around. Victor Young won the Academy Award. He had 21 nominations in a row, and he won his one and only Oscar 6 months after he died in Palm Springs of a heart attack. And
Was that for Around the World in 80 Days?
Yes, yes. And my uncle...
Was that the one, was that with David Niven in it?
David Niven,
that,
yeah.
That was a wonderful movie.
Yeah, it was really an uplifting movie, and it was a really, it was a neat movie. You know, David Niven was great in it, and Kassenflotz was very good, and Shirley MacLaine, everybody. Frank Sinatra even was in it. But so Harold wrote the words 2 weeks before the nominations were already in before the award ceremonies, so he could not be nominated for an Academy Award because the nominations were already voted on. And he was nominated for An Affair to Remember, and that was a great movie, too, with Cary Grant and Deborah Carr.
All right, hold that thought, because we're going to have to bring our friends from the Great Northwest back here at Radio Liberty that right now. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening is Bruce Adamson. Of course, we're talking about the videos that are going to be shown this evening. And, of course, one of them, was that your uncle?
Uncle Harold, yeah.
Uncle Harold.
He wrote Time on My Hands, A Lovely Way to Spend an Evening. And he wrote Frank Sinatra's first Academy Award nomination for the song I Couldn't Sleep a Wink Last Night in the movie Higher and Higher.
And so basically then this is sort of a video giving the story of his life?
Yes, it's a documentary, and Wes Sims of KION did a great job of narration, and he did went out of his way. And then Professor Steve Hanley at Cabrillo College helped greatly by editing it. And it was just something, a passion of love. You know, as a genealogist, I get into certain things, and then if I believe in them enough, I'll go all the way. And so we were able to put it together and get it on public access in Sacramento and Los Angeles and other areas. And that's anybody across the country, if they wanted to sponsor the video, it's just a matter of the duplication service. They can get it on in their community if they want to sponsor it. Either video, 1,000 Points of Light or An Affair to Remember, Harold Adamson. And they're educational videos, and there's no profit in there. You know, it just helps people understand what really happened in the JFK assassination. And then on Harold Adamson, he was a disabled songwriter. He had polio in his hand, and yet he was literally proved that the pen was mightier than the sword during World War II. He wrote such hits as he was honored by the Department of Defense for Buy a Bond, and then most of your World War II vets will remember the song Coming in a Wing and a Prayer. That was that was his one of the biggest songs during World War II, and he wrote for Carmen Miranda, Deanna Durbin, and just a lot of great songs. Hilo Hattie, he wrote 3 Hawaiian songs, Island Serenade, and then his uncle was Ernest Martin. I go into a little family history on the Adamson family, how his dad invented the first, not invented, but was responsible for the invention of the first stretchable clothing, Lastex. And then his uncle, my granduncle, was the chief camera engineer at Vitaphone and produced the first, synchronized movie with sound, and that was in the movie Don Juan. and a lot of the Rudolph Valentino silent movies.
Well, it sounds like he was really quite a character. But, of course, the average individual doesn't know who the songwriters are, unless maybe they're Rodgers and Hammerstein or something of that sort. But usually the songwriters simply may put in the music. But, of course, without music, why these movies would not have anywhere near the impact they do.
Yeah, Harold was partners with Jimmy McHugh, you know, and a lot of, you know, old-timers will remember Jimmy McHugh. And that was his longest partner. But he wrote with other people like Doris Fields, Alfred Newman, Jerome Kern, and he wrote for Marilyn Monroe. I mean, if you want to go back to the Kennedys, he wrote in 1951 Howard Hughes production. It wasn't a Howard Hughes production. But he did write for two Howard Hughes movies, His Kind of Woman and The Las Vegas Story. But Gentlemen Prefer Blondes with Marilyn Monroe and Jane Russell. He wrote two songs in that movie. But an interesting point was His Kind of Woman, the Howard Hughes production, who DeMarco claimed was friends with Howard Hughes. It's about this man being sent to Mexico City as a patsy. And it was really a good movie with Robert Mitchum, and Vincent Price was just excellent in the movie, and Raymond Burr was the bad guy. It was just it was like 10, 11 years before the assassination of Kennedy, and yet it was setting somebody up, and it's a conspiracy to set somebody up, and Howard Hughes worked with the CIA.
Well, I think that is really what most of our people don't understand, is that here's this multi-billionaire, but Howard Hughes was working with the CIA, and many of our very wealthy people do work for the CIA. You run into this, I mean, many even of our major oil men have ties to the CIA in one way or another.
Sure.
So there is this web of subversion. These people of great wealth certainly can utilize the facilities of the CIA to advance their agendas and vice versa. Well, we're going to be back here in just a minute with our special guest, Bruce Adamson. We're going to be talking about these videos. And if you want to accept any calls, if we can get them?
Sure, I guess.
All right, when we get back, if you'd like to call, the number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But remember, the movies will be on Channel 27 here in the Monterey Bay Area, cable and television, and just at the end of this program. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty really is listener-supported, and if you enjoy our programs and you think they're worthwhile, we do hope that some of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do, 5 hours every day, starting at 7 in the morning and ending at 10 o'clock at night. But what a unique opportunity to be on various networks of reaching out across America by radio, shortwave, satellite, and, of course, on the Internet. Anybody can hear our programs anywhere in the world on the Internet at RadioLiberty.com. So if you want to help us and you can join the Radio Liberty family, it's as simple as picking up your telephone and calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, of course, it's the same telephone number. Just ask, I think, probably for the September newsletter, which contains the testimony of Mindy Kleinberg, whose husband was in the North Tower of the World Trade Center on September 11th, the year 2001. And this is a testimony she gave in March of this year before the new congressional committee that is looking into the assassination. Of course, totally blacked out by the controlled media, because she asked some very, very provocative questions. And the one thing, of course, is they don't want the American people to think. So we include her entire testimony, and we'll be glad to send that to you free of charge, along with my comments there. Just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, we ask you to consider going to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. You can listen to our internet programs there. You can, of course, pull down our archive programs, or a good number of those that you can listen to going back maybe about 6 or 8 weeks. You can pull down our newsletters. You can see some of the items that we offer that you may be interested in. So just remember the website, radioliberty.com. And then, of course, you can help us get the word out by telling other people about the radio programs here on either on Radio Liberty or on the American Christian Network. And, of course, tell them about our website, www.radioliberty.com. And we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, Dr. Stan, and of course our guest this evening, Bruce Adamson, and we're talking really about the videos which he has put together, and if you want more information on them, you can go to our website, and there's a direct link to Bruce's website, and of course our website of RadioLiberty.com, and then of course you can go to Bruce's website. Now, you refer to 1,000 Points of Light. What is the title of that video?
1,000 Points of Light, G period H period W period Bush and the JFK assassination.
So it's 1,000 Points of Light, G H W Bush and the JFK assassination. Now, what's 1,000 Points of Light signify?
That signifies George Bush's famous quote. Herbert Walker Bush is quoted as saying 1,000 points of light.
But, of course, what was the significance of that phrase? I think the average person heard that, and they thought it was talking about 1,000 people working on various issues to help mankind. Have you ever gotten into the origin of these points of light that they refer to?
Well, I thought of that when the shuttle busted up over Texas, you know, not to be morbid, but the title that I refer to is that the evidence pointing to George Herbert Walker Bush and his role in the JFK assassination. That's what it signifies, in my opinion.
Well, of course, at one point in one of his talks, President Bush or George Herbert Walker Bush had actually referred to 1,000 points of light. And most Americans, of course, thought, as I said earlier, he was talking to a lot of people working for the common good. But, of course, this reference to 1,000 points of light is a reference that comes from the writings of Alice Bailey, who talked very, very frequently about points of light, this energy, of course, that will motivate people to accomplish the Great Commission. And, of course, Alice Bailey was an occultist, and others in excellent books. Going into the background of these phrases, I have many of Alice Bailey's books, and of course she recurrently refers to the 1,000 points of light, or to the points of light that of course will guide mankind, or towards the Luciferian program that she was advocating. And it is such an interesting thing that she talked not only about 1,000 points of light, she also talked about or at least the points of light. She also talked about the New World Order, which, of course, President Bush did popularize during his administration, and yet Alice Bailey had talked about that 50 years before. Why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit more about that video there, Bruce?
Okay, well, I make an interesting connection to September 11th that I think is interesting. And that is that in 1964, Muhammad Al-Fayed is in conducting business with George DeMarcia while he's in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. And this is the father of Dodi Al-Fayed, who was killed with Princess Diana. And Muhammad Al-Fayed, at the time, was in 64. I won a case this year against the CIA, in which he was then, in 1964, considered the senior officer of Egyptian intelligence. Well,
Al-Fayed was actually working for Egyptian intelligence.
In 64.
And he was in Haiti, and didn't he have an affair with DeMarcia's
daughter? Right. Yes, right. That's right. And that one of the volumes has that actual document where James Angleton is monitoring this affair. But what was important was the important fact is that Muhammad Al-Fayed is representing El Amir Atta, and they're... He's pretending to be a Kuwaitian oil man when in reality both Muhammad El Amir Atta and Muhammad Al-Fayed are from Cairo, Egypt. That's their hometown.
Now, of course, is this Atta you're talking about any relationship to the Atta who gained fame as far as the September 11th attack?
Well, it's the same name as the father of the man who crashes into the tower. And
is there any relationship? I mean, there must be a lot of Muhammad Attas out there. It seems like everybody's named Muhammad over there. And
Muhammad is a common name. Atta is not.
Okay.
And so I did, you know, there are a few of them, but how many El Amir Attas could you have in Cairo, Egypt? There's not, you know, there's not a handful, but the idea is that there is a motive for September 11th, because 2 months before the crash, September 11th, Muhammad Al-Fayed lost a lawsuit against the Pentagon and the CIA, and he's being represented by the American Civil Liberty Union lawyers, and he wanted to access to the 1,100 pages they had on Princess Diana.
In other words, he wanted to find out why his son died, because he didn't think it was an accident. He thought there was
a
conspiracy behind the murder of a Princess Diana and his son.
That's right, and he could be right.
Well, of course, if the CIA has nothing to hide, why would they refuse to turn that information over?
That's right, and so that was an interesting connection.
What happened with the lawsuit?
He lost.
Why does CIA...
He lost on July 13th, 2001, 2 months before the crash.
Well, of course, was it this because we had to conceal that information because we didn't want the Princess Di to find out what the CIA was doing, or why would they withhold that information?
National security.
How would the death of a British princess and, of course, the son of Al-Fayed influence American national security, or is that the cover that they always use to conceal the truth
from
the American people?
That's the cover. And Diana was stirring up quite a fuss over the landmines. She was really, you know, pointing out how women and children all over the world were losing their arms and legs by stepping on these landmines, and she was representing the Red Cross. And it just so happened to be that the U.S. and Britain are the largest producers of landmines. So that was an interesting point. But the interesting connection is that both Muhammad Al-Fayed and George Herbert Walker Bush were, at that time, friends with Lee Harvey Oswald's best friend, George de Mornschil. So I couldn't really connect Muhammad Al-Fayed to the JFK assassination. But then I was able to look at Muhammad Al-Fayed's brother-in-law, who happens to be the wealthiest man in the world in the 70s and 80s, Anan Khashoggi. And he is the Saudi, personal advisor to the Saudi royal family. And he was George Herbert Walker Bush's main man for Iran-Contra as vice president under Ronald Reagan. And I thought that was kind of significance. You have George Herbert Walker Bush working with Edwin Pauley in the Bay of Pigs invasion, and you have him working with Anan Khashoggi in Iran-Contra. Well,
Bruce, want to talk right in the microphone there.
Okay, you have George Herbert Walker Bush working with Edwin Pauley in the Bay of Pigs invasion, and then he's working with Anan Khashoggi in the Iran-Contra fiasco. Well, Edwin Pauley, who was a good friend, who was listed three times in George de Mornschil's phone book, owned an island in Hawaii called Coconut Island. And Anan Khashoggi was a frequent visitor to this island. On this island, Edwin Pauley, the chairman of the Democratic Party of California, he has his own pavilion named in his honor at UCLA, had a direct line to the White House and counseled. He was voted Secretary of Navy under Roosevelt. And I think it was Harold Ickes. Am I pronouncing his name right?
Harold Ickes.
Ickes, who fought that. And Pauley threatened somebody in open court at that time. But so Edwin Pauley is friends with de Mornschil, and he's working with George Herbert Walker Bush in the Bay of Pigs invasion, owns this island in Hawaii where Anan Khashoggi is a frequent visitor, and as the Marcuses Marcoses of the Philippines?
Fernando Marcos.
Right. So, Khashoggi had owned a condominium in New York City called the Olympia Towers. He had two floors.
Two floors in New York City?
New York City.
That's a pretty good-sized condominium.
Yes, he paid $36 million in the 1970s, but 6-7 months before the crash of September 11th, he sold them for $17 million, half the price, and there was no appreciation in value. In fact, it was cut. So whether they're, I thought that was interesting. And then Khashoggi's nephew publishes a book that you can find on the website, and that is The Indestructible Pilot, and he's in Saudi Arabia. So Riyadh.
Well, I mean, what is the significance of this book, The Indestructible Pilot?
Well, just the importance of pilots, of flying.
Okay, well, of course that. Well, anyway, of course, there's so many interesting connections here we find these elitists all seem to know one another, and of course they tie back to Lee Harvey Oswald.
Right. They made him out to be this loser, and that's the gold nugget, is that this loser that they made him out to be, his best friend, is really not his best friend, because nobody would set you up to take the fall for the assassination if you were innocent.
And well, now, of course, my understanding is that de Mortel wrote something called
I'm a Patsy. Right.
Was a book, or what was it?
Yes, it's published in the House Select Committee on Assassination.
And what is it basically, the theme of? This is de Mortel talking about the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald was a patsy for someone.
That's right, that he felt responsible, and that in there, there's a quote in there, of course I killed Kennedy, from the biggest crook west of in the Western Hemisphere. And then he refers to himself, but whether it's a little wishy-washy in the book. Don't know if you can take it seriously. And he refers to there's some things that are interesting there.
Now, when was this book actually written? Do you know?
It was written before his suicide, and
was this many, many years after the assassination?
Well, the assassination was in '63, and he killed himself. Outside of Palm Beach in 77, after they gave him 9 shock treatments while Bush was CIA director. And he's corresponding with Bush, but the letters are missing.
The letters are
between Bush,
right?
Yeah.
All right. So, but anyway, of course, was it, sometime in the mid-70s that he writes this book?
Yeah.
And how does it get into the Congress? Is that part of the Select Committee report?
That is.
That's the final report that actually came up with the conclusion that there was a conspiracy.
There are about 12 volumes, these big volumes. It's kind of like the Warren Commission, but a lot of it, I couldn't follow, and I was more interested in George de Mortel because they did a little timeline on de Mortel, and I had been focusing on de Mortel since 1992, and, just haven't stopped, and everything about de Mortel, it sticks, it doesn't, when you have a coincidence, usually it'll drop off, or if there are some weird coincidence, but everything just holds to them. And
the thing is, Bruce, the fact that the American people didn't learn the relationship between the CIA and the murder of an American president, and the fact that here is an organization that is a government unto itself. And, of course, immediately after the September 11th attack, the president, George W. Bush, goes to see George Tenet, the director of the CIA, and instead of firing him, he congratulates him for a job well done, and then leaves this man to continue as the director of the CIA after there are 3,000 Americans dead. Now, those of you who've heard our program before know of Robert Baer's book. Robert Baer was a CIA agent, the senior agent in Iraq in 1995. And in his book, See No Evil, he quotes a very highly placed CIA agent who is not named, but is telling a reporter friend of his off the record that when the dust settles after September 11th, the American people will realize that what had happened was not a failure for American intelligence, but a triumph. Was not a failure, but a triumph for the CIA. 3,000 Americans dead, and now, of course, we're going to war. And that is a triumph. And you have to ask yourself, who are these people that think so little of human life? And, of course, would be involved not only in the murder of an American president, but, of course, in creating wars all throughout the world with mass genocide taking place, backing, of course, the Al-Qaeda terrorists in Bosnia in the mid-1990s and certainly in the year 1999-2000, balking Al-Qaeda's people in Kosovo. We backed Al-Qaeda time and time and time again, but we can't let the American people know that. They might wake up to what's really going on. If you're out there in the listening audience, our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question for Bruce about the research he's done, he is certainly the world's leading expert on George de Moonshield. Go ahead, Bruce.
Well, I would just say that the CIA has a writer, a spokesman, that wrote the script of September 11th in the book High Flight. They have it up there at Boulder Creek Public Library. It's written by David Hagberg, and it's about these international men getting together and crashing in 14 books. 14 books. It sounds like my CD. No, 14 planes into major cities throughout the U.S., causing the U.S. stock market to crash.
Oh, I'm sorry. When was this book? It's called High Flight?
Yeah, it came out in 95.
95.
Yeah, and then there was a sequel called Joshua's Hammer, about Bin Laden and his nuclear suitcase bomb. And it, there was fiction. It's not supposed to be fact.
Now, of course, who wrote the book?
David Hagberg.
David Hagberg.
Right. Berg.
David Hagberg.
Berg. B-E-R-G. And then another interesting thing was that Hagberg and Muhammad Atta were staying in the same community in, I think it was Venice Beach, Florida, or Vero Beach, Florida.
Is there any, do we know whether there's any connection between them?
I don't know, but it's, you know, it's there. And then one of the things that you mentioned on September 11th is Bush appointed one of de Moonshield's friends to be in charge of the investigation.
Oh, you mean, was de Moonshield tied into Kissinger then?
Right, right. Yeah, Kissinger was very good friends with Dmitry von Moonshield and Dmitry von Moonshield's best friend and founder of this of a CIA organization. And
now, for our listeners, Dmitry von
brother,
right? This is the brother, right?
Right. And then he was very good friends with a guy named William Henry Chamberlain, who was a writer for the Wall Street Journal. And William Henry Chamberlain, son-in-law. Mr. Epstein was Kissinger's best friend at Harvard. Throughout the 50s, they were just real, they were very tight.
All right, fine. Well, of course, so we have Henry Kissinger tied to de Moonshield's brother.
Right.
All right. Is there any direct tie between de Moonshield and Kissinger, George de Moonshield?
Yes. In the video, if you tape it, there are two letters that Henry Kissinger was Secretary of State under Richard Nixon, is representing de Moonshield while he's in Haiti, or actually over his Haitian deal that he had with Papa Doc Duvalier.
Now, you mean de Moonshield had a deal or Kissinger had a deal?
De Moonshield.
I see. And so what was he doing? What was he exploiting there?
He was surveying the island, their half of the island. Haiti. The other half is the Dominican Republic.
Right, okay, so and then where does Kissinger come into that?
Well, he's Secretary of State, and he's friends with Dmitry von Moonshield, and he's looking out for de Moonshield's interest and trying to get him his compensation.
Okay. So, of course,
this is the man in charge of investigating the September 11th, 2001 crash.
Well, of course, he was the man that, of course, George wanted to actually head the commission. He, of course, refused to, partly because he would have to expose all of his connections, all of his clients, but even, I think, more so because the families of the victims of 9/11 didn't want him. They didn't trust him. They let it be known from the very beginning that Kissinger was not a man of integrity.
Well, I did. There's a lawyer down in L.A. who is representing 62 families of the victims, and I did make the video available to her. Mary Shavavo. I can't pronounce her last name.
Now, who are they actually suing?
They're suing. That's a good question. I think it's the government for not the airplane companies.
And, the air company. Okay.
Yeah, and her resume looks like it's right out of the Pentagon. I mean, I don't know her. You know, I haven't communicated, but I called about 10 times and let her, know that this video that indirectly ties Bush Sr. to Mohammed Atta through these common connections, whether they're real or have merit, I'm not the one to be the judge. I just want to, you know, make it available.
In other words, somebody would really have to do a lot more study to be absolutely certain that the Atta that you were talking about was the same, was related to the Mohammed Atta of course, 9/11 fame.
Not a lot of research. The research was already done, and it was done by Mohammed Al-Fayed's arch enemy, Tiny Rowland. So he wrote a book, quite a lengthy book, on Mohammed Al-Fayed, A Hero from Zero. And in there you will see that El Amir Atta is the one behind Mohammed Al-Fayed.
Well, how did Al-Fayed, as an Egyptian intelligence officer, get enough money to become one of the richest people in Great Britain?
To own the Ritz Hotel in Paris.
And Harrods in London, right.
And he became the power of attorney to the Sultan of Brunei.
So how does a lowly intelligence agency get to this?
The Egyptian government. The Egyptian government put him in that position, and they wanted him right in place where they felt that he could do the most good.
And how is he helping? Do we have any idea what he's doing for the Egyptian government?
His CIA folder was not that big. There was portions blocked out, but what I did get...
You actually got some of this from the CIA then?
Yeah, this year.
All right.
And that's when I found out that he was the senior officer of Egyptian intelligence.
All right.
Just this year.
Now, for our listeners, of course, Bruce actually has brought some suits against the CIA under the Freedom of Information
Act. And the FBI Act. The FBI, rather. I won one in 93 or 4 against the FBI. In there were unredacted documents from the CIA that James Angleton was monitoring De Mortchel's mail illegally. And also monitoring Mohammed Al-Fayed's affair with De Mortchel's daughter.
Gee, isn't it amazing that we're told the FBI and the CIA just couldn't do any of these things because there were laws against them, and yet you found out that they were doing it irrespective of the laws.
Right.
And I'd like to suggest, of course, that most of what we've been told about our lack of intelligence really isn't true. We've got the best intelligence in the whole world. We've tracked down and captured or killed 2/3 of the leadership of Al-Qaeda. The only one we can't seem to find is Osama bin Laden. And yet, if you've read the book, Richard Miniter's book, Losing Bin Laden, he points out that on 12, that is 12 separate occasions, we had an opportunity to capture him or have him turned over to us, and each time we refused to do it. And then, of course, in Afghanistan, they refused to allow the special forces units to go after Osama bin Laden. Instead, they told the Afghans, who loved bin Laden, that it was up to them to capture him. And yeah, they captured him, took him right over into Pakistan where he'd be safe. How could you be so stupid unintentionally? But of course, Osama bin Laden is the best enemy we can possibly hate. And as long as he is there, we can continue to justify the war on the freedom of the American people we call the war on terrorism.
Are we getting near the end?
We're just about, yeah. Do you have a couple of points you'd like to make?
Yeah, I'd like to point out that if anybody is going to watch the video, that they may not want to have kids around because there are pictures of De Mortchel having committed suicide, and that a CIA agent threatened George Herbert Walker Bush, and he's found dead with Bush's phone number on him. That's on there. And then another man, Che Guevara, was in possession of George Herbert Walker's best friend, Felix Rodriguez, and he was killed right after the picture was taken. But I just wanted to, and on there you will find the video, De Mornchel's daughter discovering her father, and she was the one that had the love affair with Mohammed Al-Fayed. But I thought it would be proper, and I wish I could have produced this controversial video with somebody like Wes Sims, who did such an excellent job with the Harold Adamson video's voice, because I'm not the greatest speaker. You know, I have a lot of good information, but and I think the video is good, but one needs to get it on tape and to see where the pieces fit in order to understand it. And I would just close that the CD, or if any of the books anybody wants to purchase, that I will donate like around 30% to Radio Liberty.
Oh, fine. Well, of course, you'll have to do that. We're non-commercial. So if anybody would like the information, go to our website, and there's a link over there to Bruce's website, and a fascinating information about a fascinating time and part of our history. Well, Bruce, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. Our guest has been Bruce Adamson. If you're living in the Monterey Bay area, you can, of course, watch those videos the next hour on Channel 27. And if you're up in the north,
Santa Cruz.
Santa Cruz cable television. And, of course, if you are in the great Northwest, of course, you can contact Bruce and get the information. So anyway, thank you so much for being with us, and we'll look forward to having you with us again in the not too distant future.
And I can make the video available too, if anybody's listening in the distance.
All right, fine. Bye-bye, and thanks so very much.
Bye-bye.
We'll be back with our listeners in the Great Northwest tomorrow evening at the same time. And then, until then, of course, pray for America. Pray for revival, because truly behind what's going on are dark and sinister spiritual forces. And please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Good evening again. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, and supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because, of course, we're hoping to have with us in just about a minute and a half our good friend John Loeffler, and we're going to be talking about what's going on over in the Middle East, and, of course, the tragedy of what's occurring, because it's amazing how easily it is to manipulate the American people into a war, the way we were manipulated into the war in Vietnam. Oh, my goodness, the wicked communists. If we don't, of course, they get those wicked communists, why the dominoes will fall. And, of course, it'll be Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos, and then Australia and San Francisco will be next. And the American people really bought that. Without understanding, we financed the North Vietnamese all during the Vietnam War. And those of you who haven't either seen my video, The Best Enemies Money Can Buy, or read the book, The Best Enemies Money Can Buy, I really don't understand what happened in Vietnam. We have a wonderful four-tape set on Vietnam, the untold story of the men we left behind, or one man came back, a wonderful material on Vietnam. And when you understand that our boys weren't allowed to win, they were restricted as far as what they could bomb. We could have bombed the dikes in North Vietnam and ended the war overnight. We could have bombed the hydroelectric plants, knocked out the electricity, which of course knocked out Hanoi and all the production capacity. We could have, of course, bombed the harbor at Haiphong or mined the harbor, or bombed the rail line so they couldn't move their supplies. We were never allowed to win the war. The war was fought, of course, to change America, just as, of course, the current war on terrorism is being fought to change America. And if you go into the background of the Patriot Act, and you find out that this is the first step in a police state, and, of course, we'll do some programs on the Patriot Act in the near future, and, of course, give you more information. But they're collecting dossiers on every person in America, on your medical records, on your financial records, on the things you buy, the things you use your credit card for. Every time you make a phone call, there's a record. Everything is being kept because they're tracking, not the Islamic terrorists, because they arrested all of them immediately after September 11th. Why? Remember, they picked up 1,200 Muslims? How did they know who to arrest immediately after that? And there have been no terrorist attacks in the United States, really significant ones, since 9/11 of 2001. How could that be? Because we arrested their whole terrorist network. How did we know who they were? We'd been watching them all along. But we can't let the American people know that. They might then ask if we were watching them, and we knew who the terrorists were, and we had to, because within 2 hours of the attack, and you need to read Kristen Breitweiser's testimony, which is my September 2000 newsletter. But if you read that newsletter, you find that, according to the New York Times, within 2 hours of the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the FBI was at the restaurants where the terrorists ate, at the neighborhoods where they lived, at the flight schools where they trained. See, how could they do that within 2 hours if we had no idea who they were? And how did they know who those 1,200 Muslims were to arrest? And, of course, we can't release their names because we don't want Osama bin Laden to know. We can't, of course, try them because we'd have to release sensitive information, and Osama bin Laden would know what we knew at the time of the attack. And if you believe that sort of nonsense, why you're incredibly naive. This whole thing is a cover-up, not to prevent Osama bin Laden or Muhammad Atta from finding out what happened, but to keep the American people from learning the truth. Right now, on the line from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, John Loeffler. Hi, John.
Well, Stan, you know, the hardest thing I've been trying to do, in line with what you were just talking about, has been to connect all the dots for people and to show them all of what I call seemingly divergent trends, which are really coming together. For example, what does education and some of the education bills have to do with the war on terror? Why are these things even related? Well, they're related in the following ways. Number one, in education, we're now going to track everybody from womb to tomb. They will have predetermined outcomes, which they have to meet, 50% of which are politically correct attitudes that have nothing to do with academics. Now, if you don't pass that, then you'll be prohibited from getting a job, or at least from even getting into an institution of higher learning. That's how it ties in with this entire giant record-keeping system that we're having out there, is that not only are we just keeping records on people, but now we're redefining what mental health is, what tolerance is, what diversity is, and we're actually beginning to enforce, through indirect methods at first, what people believe and what they think. And as soon as you get outside of this level of tolerance, you know, I was just listening to Police Detective Phil Wartz again lecturing on consensus this week. I was listening to some of his recordings, and he was saying the same thing. You know, we hear a lot about tolerance. It's not really very tolerant at all as soon as you get outside of the accepted margins, it becomes very ruthless about trying to remediate you by force and violence necessary. That's what we're talking about.
And it's just, you know, it's so difficult for the American people to believe that they're collecting dossiers on every individual on what, the books that they read, certainly on their medical records, on their financial records, what they buy and where they buy it and who they're talking to. And, of course, now, of course, they've always violated the laws. The NSA has been listening to the emails and reading the emails, listening to the telephone conversations, reading the faxes, anything electronic. They're keeping a record on.
Well, I mean, that's pretty much the direction that it's going. And the reason it gets spooky is it's one thing to have the information, but the next question is, why do you have this information? Why do you need this information?
Well, of course, we're fighting terrorism. That's what they're going to tell the American people. But that
isn't
the truth. Really, they want the records because, of course, we're moving into a fascist dictatorship. And it's not just on the American people. This is being expanded all throughout the world to keep track of everybody in the world. Of course, they'll have the best records here in America. But as time goes by, their plan is to track every living human being.
Right, and to sift through that data for signs of suspicious behavior.
In other words,
remember what I said about, see, here's the thing. Well, the next line would be, well, if you're not a criminal, you don't have anything to worry about. But see, the definition of criminal, Dr. Stan, is changing now. Barrett Choate just wrote an excellent series on, you know, the next outlay for what mental health is. And so the number of crimes are becoming thought crimes, speech crimes, hate crimes, belief crimes. It's taking a little time to get there, but we'll get there. So you see, on one side, the mechanism is being put in place to monitor and track. On the other, the mechanism is being put in place to try to coerce people into what they should think and believe about life and their government and how they should interface with society. And so it's very easy from that point on to begin to try to thrush out people who are not following these patterns and then to begin to try to apply coercive measures. Remember, one of the greatest measures of coercion and torture in the Soviet Union that was used was the mental health profession, so to speak, which is why 40 years ago they wouldn't allow the Soviets into the international mental health associations and things like that, because they knew they were using it as a form of imprisonment and torture.
Well, of course, the tragedy is today that they're using our schools to change the attitudes and values and beliefs of our children. And, of course, the greatest power grab of all time has been the federal control of the education of K through 12. And that's what the No Child Left Behind legislation is. And that is, of course, what George Bush was able to get through, because Teddy Kennedy couldn't get it through and Bill Clinton couldn't get it through. But after all, when we have a Republican Christian administration, why, I mean, who could object to what they're doing? And yet, that's because the average person has never looked into this. We have a four-tape set called Fed Ed, and we have a book called Fed Ed by Alan Quist. I know you've talked to Alan. It's so vitally important you understand what they're going to do to the heart and mind and soul of American children in government schools, but not just in government schools, because they've infiltrated the private schools, they've infiltrated the Christian schools, and I'm sure they're trying to infiltrate the home schooling movement because they want the souls of our children.
And they didn't actually do a lot of infiltration, because they've all bought into the dialectical process of education. That is so very hard to explain to parents or to Christians in the system, because they say, well, gee, I don't see what's wrong with that. I don't see what's wrong with one of Rick Warren's books. They don't have the background and the education to see. So the dumbing down of America that Charlotte Isherby talks about has now flooded through the church as well. There's a huge amount. I remember walking with a Calvary Chapel pastor and Chuck Missler one night, and he said, you know what the problem we have? And he was talking about just the Calvary Chapel denominations. This is the pastor, not Chuck Missler. He said, we have a problem with illiteracy in the church. And he doesn't mean whether you can read A, B, C, D, but whether or not these people have a broad-based background to begin to understand these philosophical issues. And so if you watch all of the things that the church reacts to out there on a day-to-day basis, the church reacts to, what I call the superficial downstream end result issues. Say, for example, Judge Moore and the Ten Commandments and things, or suddenly NAMBLA wants to go ahead and get approved and be taught in the schools along with various other sexual techniques and things of that nature. they don't understand. See, that's a downstream fight. It's basically a fight you've already lost. You lost it years ago. But they don't see the fights that are to be fought today. And there are just a handful of people who are standing up and waving red flags and firing off warning flares and everything, just cannot get the attention of the mainline churches to save their lives. Everything you just saw happen in the Episcopalian Church, they say, you know, the Episcopalian Church, and that's what my wife Carol grew up in, is a church in the process of ripping its own heart out. And what it did is it allowed a bunch of people to come in 5 decades ago who began switching the basis of the theology to this, what used to be called, you know, they call it progressive thinking or whatever you want, undermining the authority of the Scripture. And slowly but surely, the rot climbs through the whole thing until finally it takes some physical manifestation. That's what we've seen happen. So then all of a sudden, these Episcopalians, the ones who were faithful to the original calling, are out there wringing their hands. They've been through synod after synod of bishops, where the bishops are just falling apart, literally in open apostasy and or heresy. And I go, well, why did you wait this long? What is your problem? You know. And this is what really gets me in the part of it. Is I go, didn't you see this coming? You know, anybody could have told you where it's going to wind up, because it always goes in this direction. It did in Nazi Germany. How is it that we had, out of 14,000 pastors, only 4,000 refused to join the German Christian Church, which was a Nazified version of Christianity? It was, you know, it had sort of the look and the feel of a Lutheran German church, but in reality, it was Nazi through and through. It had its doctrines. How is it that these pastors didn't see it coming? And once again, in this country, we're watching the same thing. You either have them doing one of two things. One, they're burying their heads in a tremendous amount of what I call non-directive Bible babble. In other words, it's lots of Bible teaching, verse by verse, this and that, or the Pentecostals are into praising and getting your blessing from the Lord. The mainline denominations have mostly gone over in that direction. And now the evangelical churches are being riddled with these dialectically based church growth programs, which do result in an increase of the number of bodies in a church, but do not result in an increase of believers in the church. Because in order to bring in that many people, you have to compromise the doctrine that you're teaching. So there it is. In a time of crisis, when understanding the nature of the paradigm changes that we're going through, when it's called for, when it would be time to call and to yank the kids and to say, it's time we educate our children, that's it, we're out of this struggle, we refuse to engage in it. You have a church which, well, frankly, has a hard time finding toilet paper in the dark.
Well, I think the biggest thing, of course, is to understand what's wrong with, of course, this whole consensus program that is infiltrating the church growth movement. And, of course, what people have to understand is that seminal to the whole church growth movement is small groups. Would you like to sort of develop that idea? And, in fact, what's really so significant to me is we came across something put out by the Theosophists, and those of you who don't know, they're the Satanists, they're written by Alice Bailey, talking about how, of course, the whole key to the accomplishment of this new world order and the transformation of society will be the groups, the small groups. In fact, they use that term about 8 times, you know, in one page, and I'm reading this, and it is just so reminiscent of what's happening in the church growth movement now. And, of course, the key to the whole church growth movement is the small group. So pick up that story.
Well, it's not just in the church growth movement. It was interesting when we look back at Francis Schaeffer 20 years ago. And Schaeffer warned, he said, if the church ever takes up this mode of speaking, and I forget how he called it, he didn't use the word dialectic, but he understood it was the very same relativist system, he said, very soon the church would wind up looking exactly like the world around it and totally unable to stand as a witness against the spirit of the age because it had adopted the very same principles. That's why it's so hard, and we'll get to the small groups in a sec, that's why it is so hard to explain this to people. I had a friend of mine who had just read one of Rick Warren's books, and I know Bob Klink talks a lot more about this, and I emailed him back. I said, be careful of that. He said, well, the book did a lot for me. I don't see what's wrong with it. See, we're so blurred now on what is biblical or what is even didactic, meaning a system of logic and reason, even if it isn't a Christian system. They're so blurred right now, when confronted with a conflicting mode, and it's not what you believe, it's how you believe it. It's the actual vehicle that you use to arrive at your conclusions, the process, so to speak.
And what they've really done, what they've really done is they of course learned how to control the mind of the American people, but specifically the Christians would be the one group who ordinarily would be objecting to what's going on. And of course they get them into small groups, and of course then instead of didactic teaching about the scriptures, why very often what they'll do is get them discussing the scriptures. How do you feel about it? How do you feel about it?
Right. Well, the whole thing, remember, the whole process of the dialectic is designed to bring people to a predetermined outcome by using group pressure to achieve the result that you're looking for. That's important to understand. In other words, everybody wants to be approved. Everybody wants to be liked as a good guy. But so what they do is they use group pressure to coerce the dissenters. Now, you can always tell when a church growth program has come in, because a couple of people will go and say, you know, we don't think this is biblical, Pastor. And the pastor will tell them, you'd better go find another church, or you'd better leave. Now think about this, Dr. Stan. Here they are, they've been in a church, some of them for 10, 20 years. Suddenly, somebody out of the blue, some Yahoo pastor comes along and says, we're going to do this. This is our vision now. Now, first of all, it's not their vision. Somebody decided it was, quote, our vision. And they're going to do this. And if the person disagrees or brings up a scriptural challenge, this whole system, there is an entire process in this church growth movement that is called dealing with dissenters. There's something radically wrong here with this, okay? Because the whole Christian church is supposed to rotate on a model of accountability to each other.
And I think that the fact that they specifically will tell you that the dissenters have to be really put out. They talk about the elderly people in the church. They're the pillars of the church, and the pillars of the church are holding up development. Pillars, we ordinarily think, holding up the ceiling. Well, the pillars of the church are holding up development, holding up progress. And, of course, the elderly people, the people who have been there before, well, we'd be better off without them. And they actually have a program get people out of the church who will not go along with their program. Now, that is not a very Christian attitude. You would think they wouldn't want to discuss the issues. No, they want to get rid of them because, of course, if they start talking, they might convince the rest of the people that everything they're being told is a lie.
Well, especially if they start raising biblical questions to some of the nonsense and the process. Remember, the thing about consensus is it's not what is taught as much as how it's taught, the process of thought that is used to achieve it. And what it is, you know, my bottom line that I finally emailed back to my friend is I said, let me give you the bottom line on this. This consensus process was birthed in the bowels of Marxism. It was the process that the Soviets used for 70 years to indoctrinate their school children. It is a process based on relative values, which are anathema to the scripture. It is a process designed to deceive and coerce and get everybody acting in common in the common collective. It's a communitarian type of approach. How the heck can you even say we can reconcile this with any concept of Christian teaching or thought?
I don't really think that's really what's so vitally important. The thing is that there are absolutes. There is a right and there is a wrong. And they don't want to address that. They want, of course, to get us to be willing to compromise our position to go along and to be well-liked by the group. Because
we want a dialogue about
right,
it.
Right. And they want to change just a little bit at a time. Now, apparently sometimes they preach pretty good sermons there in the service. But, of course, it is the identification with the group that gets you to begin to alter your position, because the last thing you would want, of course, to have to be forced out of the group and lose your friends and be known as the dissenter.
Well, and that's where, you know, Dean Gocher frequently says that the word martyrios, from which we get the word martyr from, in Greek means witness. And at that point, you become a witness for the whole thing because you have to witness for the truth. But unfortunately, in order to witness for the truth, you're probably going to have to take some heat. See, that's where, again, consensus destroys people's ability to stand, because they can't take any heat. In other words, it's not going to be popular to stand up for what is right, but that was always what we were raised to do when I was growing up. Okay, you may not be popular, but always aim for the right, stand up for what is righteousness, defend those who need defending. Today, I doubt you could find anybody who would understand that, because they have been told that the purpose of religion is to, or at least the Christian religion, is to fulfill their basic needs and help them through their neuroses, and basically we have psychologized the religion. And so, you know, I'm very optimistic for the people who are still walking in faith. I'm extremely pessimistic for the people who are joining this, because I understand that in a time of trial, they will not be able to stand. They absolutely will not be able to stand. We went to another Calvary Chapel this couple of weeks ago. I always like to go around to different churches and see what's going on. And they held the pastor of this particular church. And he's a really good-hearted man. He was out. He had a guest pastor. And during the course of the sermon, the pastor started talking about Melchizedek in the Old Testament. And he stops for a second. He says, just out of curiosity, how many people in the congregation don't know who Melchizedek is? And I thought, oh, this should be interesting. And about half the congregation there raises their hands. And I leaned over to my wife and I said, we're in trouble. If we don't even understand the basics of faith, do it. And I had a similar experience a couple of years ago when we were at a Lutheran church where they were screening for new pastors, and the new pastors wanted to meet with a bunch of people from the church, and there were 40 of us in a room. I happened to be one of the people that they wanted to meet with. So I did something that was very hard for me. I kept my mouth shut for a solid hour and watched what was going on. And we finally got to an interesting point where the pastor, and he was probably in his early 30s, and he said, I have a couple of questions to ask you people. And he said, first of all, what is the mark of a church that, first of all, he said, where will this church be in 5 years? And he said, second of all, what is the mark of a church that has a heart to win the lost? And third of all, what does God ask from us? And those were really good theological, meditative questions that I think could be answered. And I sat there listening with bated breath to hear what the answer of 40 Missouri Synod Lutherans would be. Dr. Stan, not one of them was able to get any kind of an answer that even came close to the bullseye in the whole thing. And I finally went up afterwards and I talked to him and I said, well, let me tell you what the answers to your questions are, Pastor. I said, number one, the answer is, where will this church be in 5 years? I said, absolutely nowhere. It has no vision whatsoever. And he said, well, I can see that. And I said, what is the mark of a church that has a heart to win the lost? A sense of urgency. Time is of the essence right here. We're in a fight. We're in a battle. We have to keep moving. That's why you always hear a sound of urgency in my voice. And the third question, what does Christ ask of us? He asks us to die to self in order to carry out this task. Now, out of 40 people, there were any number of correct theological answers. They couldn't even get one, Dr. Stan. That's why we're losing this battle.
Well, I'm sure we are losing the battle. And, of course, there are many, many manifestations of this. I was this weekend with a friend of mine, Colonel Ron Ray, and he was telling me that he had a chance to talk to David Horowitz, who was, of course, raised in a Marxist family. His parents were Bolsheviks, and for many years he espoused their goals and objectives, and supposedly he has now become a good conservative, but he was testifying before a congressional committee, actually appointed, having to do with gays and women in the military. And of course, during the testimony, he said that, 50 years ago, why the Marxists took over all of the major institutions of the United States, with the exception of the military. And we thought that, of course, the Vietnam War would destroy the military, but, of course, it did not. So it was our decision that what we would do would introduce homosexuality and the women into combat units, and that would destroy the American military. Well, Colonel Ray, after the testimony was over, got to David Horowitz in the hall and said, well, what about the church? And, of course, Horowitz grinned and said, that was the easiest thing at all. I mean, we took them over, in the 1920s and 1930s. And, of course, we had our people infiltrate the Board of Deacons and the leadership of the church, and we taught them one thing. The only thing that you have to do is save souls. That's all you have to do. And, of course, not be at all involved in the activities of the general world. And, of course, they have it, of course, in the process. They've changed the message of the church, the thrust of the church, so that, I'm sure that Jonathan Edwards would not recognize modern-day Christianity. In fact, of course, John Ankerberg tells the story about addressing a group of a large group of ministers, and his talk was on hell. And when he gets up to talk on hell, half the audience gets up and leaves, and he thought, gee, it must be time for a break. And by the time he finished his talk, talking about hell, well, there was hardly anybody in the audience. So he went out into the where everybody else was, and he said, gee, was there a break or something? And the people said, well, no, we don't believe in hell. Well, if you're a minister and you don't believe in hell, I mean, a little wonder, of course, that the old-time message of, eternal damnation, and that is, of course, why Christians have to change their lives. We don't preach that in church anymore. We don't teach people that they're sinners. We don't teach them about eternal punishment. For the modern-day view of hell is, well, it's just sort of eternal separation from God. That's all there is to it. And when you die, and that's it.
Well, I mean, that has been even the Catholic Church's traditional teaching as well, that the greatest pain of hell is separation from God. But if you do away with the concept of hell, well, then you automatically do away with the concept of Christ. Okay, because the whole thing's intertwined. First of all, if there is no hell, then Jesus is a liar. Now, if Jesus is a liar, then he's not the Son of God, and we shouldn't be following him. If that's true, then we might as well cash in the chips on Christianity. See, all of this stuff connects together. And God isn't really interested in what they believe in anymore, by the way, Dr. Stan. You know, you can jump off a building saying, I don't believe in gravity, but it takes it. And there again, we've come full circle here to this didactic versus the other. How did they arrive at this concept of hell or what they do and don't believe in? And that's where it's all lost in. So we're in for an incredibly, for anybody who wishes to remain faithful here in the West, we're in for an incredibly rough ride. That's where my heart breaks. We just drove back from Seattle, and we've been talking that whole thing, almost the whole trip back, of what does this mean for people who are believers? And the bottom line, you know, David Limbaugh's new book has pretty well, it's a time of persecution, just like the good old times. You can put it all together right now. See, we have mental illness being defined as being intolerant or bigoted or not fitting the politically correct norms. Okay, if you're mental illness, that means you have to be treated, et cetera, et cetera. And then we will have to force you. So that means coercion and violence or imprisonment or detainment, having your kids removed from you. You can just see it all. It's all coming together. And how do they monitor you? Well, we have this whole system of monitoring and surveillance. I wish it were otherwise, but it sure isn't.
And, of course, if you really believe that there is a conspiracy out there, why, of course, if you believe that the government is not telling you the truth, obviously you must be paranoid. We'll be back here in just a moment or two with John Loeffler. We'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I need to mention that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you are a regular listener and you agree that there's a problem, we hope that many of you will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. It's as simple as picking up your telephone and calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Of course, we hope that many of you will want to do that, and if not, we'll be glad to send you a free copy of our newsletter. You can actually call us at that number. I'd suggest you ask for the September newsletter because, of course, it contains Mindy Kleinberg's testimony before the new investigating committee that's looking into the background of 911. And, of course, her testimony was totally censored by the controlled media. But she raises some very, very interesting questions, and so we've taken her entire testimony and included it in the September newsletter with my comments. So if you'd like a free copy of that newsletter, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, we want to remind you about our website. It's radioliberty.com, and, of course, you can pull down our radio programs there. There are links to our other networks and listen 5 hours a day and not get much of anything accomplished. Or you can, of course, pull down the archive programs. And then, of course, if you'd like to information. Our newsletters are there, and other things we've written are there, and we encourage you to pull them down, go through them, and then tell others about our website. Tell others about our newsletter. Tell them about our programs on a regular basis, because if we can get people listening, they may start out thinking we're crazy, but hopefully before long they'll be afraid we're not. Under any circumstances, you're going to have to help, and that's one thing you can do. Copy our newsletters and distribute them. Tell others about the programs, but even more than that, of course, tell them about our website, which is radioliberty.com. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and of course, our guest this evening is John Leffler, and we're just talking about the problems that really are facing the church today. A church that at one time, of course, called our politicians, called society to a higher standard, and now, of course, why we really don't want to offend anybody. We certainly would never want to speak out against politicians who lie to the public. After all, we want to be just grateful if we have anybody who talks about Christianity, and as long as they talk about Christianity, doesn't mean that many times they're saying things that just aren't true. It doesn't matter that they will say one thing one day and another thing another. It doesn't matter that they're sending our boys over to Iraq, and we're told they're going to be there, you know, until we get a democracy established. We went there to, liberate the people. They're not going to tell you the truth, and that is the plan is to keep our troops there indefinitely. And all you need to do is read the report of the Project for the New American Century at their website, newamericancentury.org, and you'll find out that this is the plan to keep our troops there indefinitely. But, of course, we can't tell the American people that. They're not smart enough to understand. Well, right now we have Mike calling in from Santa Cruz. Mike, do you have a question or comment for our guest?
Yeah, a question for John. Earlier in the program, he spoke of individuals who came into the Episcopal Church 50 years or so ago and changed things around. And I wonder if you could elaborate on just who those people were, where they came from.
Wait. I'm missing that again.
He's asking about, you made some comment about people coming into the Episcopal Church 50 years ago and changing the structure of the church.
Oh, the church that came in, the battles have been fought in almost all of the mainline denominations. And some they were called modernism, some was called liberalism, and that doesn't mean political liberalism. It's a whole different thing. Probably the hallmark of the beginning of a lot of changes, if you remember, in the Presbyterian Church, was the ouster of J. Gresham Machen at the time, who was one of the people who stood for that. I don't know if he was the one who coined the word fundamentalist or not, and he wasn't talking about it in a pejorative terminology today. What he meant is, what are the things that you must believe in order to be a Christian? And that's where the term fundamentalist came from. I mean, what are the fundamentals of the faith? It's the same thing as the Nicene Creed, the Westminster Confession, all of the things that have come along in the history of the church that people considered an adequate statement of faith. So that was the belief system. I don't have in mind a particular person, but this new dialectical process. See, here's what happened. Let me give you the history of this thing. Right about the time that Darwin came out, the church began to be faced with a problem, because all of a sudden, the humanists, who had kicked into gear about the time of Rousseau and Voltaire, had been looking, they needed a creation myth. They were having a problem in trying to keep things going, because they needed some kind of a creation myth or a story that would let them keep going and substitute for the Christian one. Well, in Darwinism, they thought they had the mechanism. So they began to run around, jumping up and down, yelling and screaming that Darwinism was science and religion was faith. There was the dichotomy. In other words, Francis Schaeffer traces that. And so rather than take on the challenge of the unity of truth out there, etc., we have the point where the church felt, certain members of the church felt they were looking stupid. So what they began to do was compromise the nature of the scriptures. They began interpolating the scriptures allegorically where necessary, ignoring them where necessary, turning them into fables and fairy tales, etc. Well, by doing so, they completely gutted the structure of what was the church. This was the change that came through. If you ever want to read some good material on this, read Francis Schaeffer's The Great Evangelical Disaster. that's a good start. And there were others that he did there as well that I think his book, the Schaefer Trilogy, is out right now. And it lists out the whole history of how we got to where we are in that status. So I don't have any Episcopalian church. I don't have anybody in mind. But this change has been, you know, and the Episcopalian church was very much affected by Vatican Council II. Vatican Council II is what blew the lid off of it for the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church did not have its anchorage in the Scriptures. It quoted Scripture as needed to support Catholic doctrine, but the basis for teaching was the teaching magisterium of the Church. When the Church threw that lid off the top of it, all of a sudden you began, I was in Catholic seminary within less than 10 years of the end of Vatican II, and you should have seen the priests and nuns and brothers there falling all over themselves to embrace all of this liberal, and again, I'm talking about theological liberalism, all of these new ideas, the relative ideas, the psychologizing of the Church, everything that Francis Schaefer warned against. And the Episcopalian Church went with it.
And, of course, Mike, the communists controlled the Union Theological Seminary. The communists infiltrated Christianity, but it wasn't just the communists, it was the humanists. And then, of course, there were the people from the occult, and basically there were, frankly, Satanists that were involved in this whole thing. And if you've never read that wonderful book by Malachi Martin called The Windswept House, and it starts with a satanic human sacrifice in the basement of the Vatican. And when I talked to Malachi, I said, you know, of course, the feigned human sacrifice in the basement of the Vatican was corresponding with a real human sacrifice taking place elsewhere. And I said to him, is this true? And he said, absolutely, everything in the book is true. We've just changed the names to protect, of course, protect us.
Right.
And,
you know, and it's amazing. I asked him the same question before he died, and I said, did that really happen? He said, yes. Remember, in that very same book, Malachi Martin predicted the coming scandal of pedophilia within the Church, and he told me that both on the air, and it was in his book, and we talked about it off the air, and he said, this whole thing is just a terrible scandal, and it's going to come out.
And if you don't think we got problems in the Protestant Church, too, I mean, you know, certainly within the Southern Baptist Church, 30-40% of the ministers are Masons. They've infiltrated every aspect of the seminaries. Fortunately, I think they've cleaned up the Southern Baptist seminaries, but I remember talking to the wife of the man who heads one of the seminaries, and she told me that she said it'll take us 20 years to undo the harm that they've done in training our Baptist ministers. So we got real problems in every aspect of Christendom because the wicked people are there, and their purpose, their goal, their prize is the destruction of Christianity.
Well, one thing I'm looking for is the Masonic influence on the Episcopal Church. And I wondered if any of that was involved in the events 50 years ago.
I don't have anything, Stan.
Well, I can tell you that I'm sure the Masons, I know very well the Masons were there. And you could certainly probably read Unholy Alliance by James Wardner, Behind the Lodge Door by Paul Fisher. And I'm sure that they would go into that at least to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, fine. Thanks very much. And then there's another wonderful book. It's called No God Next Door. And that's, of course, the story of in the 1920s of the so-called communist revolution in Mexico. But there were strong Masonic overtones to that as well. And the book is No God Next Door. And there, they simply took the priests and the nuns and they hung them from telephone poles as far as you could see. Were poles with priests and nuns hanging from them.
In all fairness, I'm going through the history of Mexico right now. The Church had put itself into that position because the Church for a long time had become, along with the Hacendados who were down in Mexico, etc., were large property owners, and they had been involved in, they were part of the problem. The revolution in 1920 was when Mexico just pulled itself absolutely apart. And it had been doing so for 100 years, since the Grito de Dolores in 1810 with Manuel Hidalgo, who was that priest who was very, not as much of a priest as he was a Rousseauite or a Jacobin. That's what kicked it off, and it lasted for 100 years. But the Church did not, you know, was not unclean in that whole thing. It made itself a target simply by the fact that it, it stood against large groups of people who needed redress of grievances and things like that. So there's I would say there's a double side to that whole story.
Well, I'm sure there is. In fact, of course, when you begin to get into a power structure, when the church begins to accumulate tremendous amounts of land and property and wealth, then, of course, it itself becomes corrupted.
I watched that happen in the religious order I was part of. Everybody takes this vow of poverty, but they soon, I talk about the dialectic, right? You know, when Francis of Assisi was along, he believed in poverty like Christ did, that they would rely on the Lord on contributions and things, very much like Buddhist monks do, although Buddhism has the same problem with corruption in certain areas. But then they begin to redefine what poverty is, and they begin to amass property and goods, and before you know it, they're in much more of a corporate position to own a lot more stuff. There was a time in Mexico, I can't remember the decades, leading up to and probably through the Grito de Dolores in 1810 and the Plan of Iguala, where basically to become a nun, you had to be rich because they wanted rich dowries to be brought in. And each of the nuns had her own personal servants. It was literally leading an aristocratic life. It was no longer leading a life of poverty or anything like that. That's why I'm saying this whole system, I used to hear this in Catholic school when I was growing up about how horrible it was what happened to the priests and nuns in Mexico, and they couldn't wear this. And I said, yeah, but if you really want to see something, and we're seeing it again here, every time evil has taken over somewhere, some big, fat, bloated church wasn't doing its job and had gone off the rails. In Russia, it was the Russian Orthodox Church, all right? They had gone off the rails and left a philosophical vacuum. In Hitler's Germany, at least there was a fight put up there by a number of Catholic and Protestant pastors, but most of them had gone off the rails. One of the stark contrasts of that was in Poland after World War II, when Stefan Cardinal Wyszynski decided to make a stand against the communists. And, of course, his protege was Karol Wojtyła, who's Pope John Paul II. They actually held off the Marxists, and they managed to keep Catholicism going in Poland. They kept Marxism from totally taking over. And what is interesting, Dr. Stan, is when the final fall, at least the pseudo-fall, came of the Berlin Wall and all of the Iron Bloc countries, it started in churches. You see, the churches were one of the few places you could keep certain things alive, even in that time. So there are always courageous people that step up to the plate, but the vast majority of the people buckle in those times. That's why I have virtually no respect for the Russian Orthodox Church, because it's been trying to push itself back into hegemony now in Russia again. I go, I'm sorry, you guys, that's it. You guys blew it, and you blew it badly, and I don't think there's been any acknowledgement of that. That was one of the issues in the early church. Do you remember that, Dr. Stamp? One of the issues in the early church was, could a person who had renounced his faith under duress, under torture, then be accepted back into the community again? That was one of the early debates. Had he committed the unpardonable sin?
And what was the final decision?
Well, some believed you could, some believed you couldn't. That was in the early part. It became a real problem in the church, this whole bit about burning. I have to go dig that one up now. I have to go grab my encyclopedia on church history.
Well, isn't that important? But, of course, the thing is that there in those days, it was a very, very, it was a difficult thing to be a Christian because, if you would not renounce your faith, they would simply burn you at the stake. And you can see why some people might, under torture, be willing to say, well, maybe I'll change my mind, with the idea that it's really not true. But once you've made that statement, of course, they've broken your spirit. And, one of the things I remember Reverend Wormbrand writing about when he was in a Romanian prison,
right,
prison for 14 years, and they constantly tortured him, trying to get him to renounce Christianity. And, of course, many of the ministers did, and he never did. And, but when he got out of prison, he couldn't understand why they wanted to get him to renounce his belief, because, after all, he wasn't any harm to them. He couldn't do anything when he was in prison. So why did they go to all this work simply to try to break his spirit? And it was that led him into, of course, a study of communism and this final realization that it was basically satanic. It was not simply atheistic, but it was frankly satanic. And he wrote his book, Marx and Satan, which I think is certainly very, very important to understand what's going on today. And it was his conclusion that Karl Marx was not an atheist. contrary to everything that was said. He was raised as a Protestant. He was Jewish, but he was raised as a Protestant. And then, of course, he eventually renounced the Protestant faith and became a Satanist.
Well, anything like that is driven that way. That's what the agenda is today. We talk about this dialectic process we started out the hour by discussing. It is identical, Dr. Stan, to the method that was used before. This is nothing new. And it was interesting, Francis Schaeffer himself said, he said, whenever the church rushes up and embraces something, it says, this is the new latest wave. And Schaeffer said, in reality, the church is the last thing down the food chain to get it. He said, it's nothing new. All right? They're just the last ones to get it.
Well, you know, of course, it's so interesting. There's nothing new under the sun. The whole battle here, are there absolutes? Is there a right? Is there a wrong? And, of course, how do we determine that? And, of course, in the Garden of Eden, why Adam and Eve were told certain things. You know, you can live in this wonderful utopia, but there are certain rules, and one of them is you will not eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And then up comes the serpent, and he says, oh, now, that really isn't true. Let's begin to question that. You know, if you eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you're not going to die. And in fact, you may be able to live forever, you know.
But remember how the Satan started out. Okay, this is important, all right? He started out by using the dialectical process, all right? He started out, he didn't say, that's not true to start with. What did he say? He said, did God say,
right.
And then he quotes God, but he quotes him making a slight twist. In other words, he twists it slightly. That's what the dialectical process does.
And that's, it really is so beautifully exemplified there, because, of course, this whole dialectic process really began in the Garden of Eden. Did God say, you know, that? And then once you raise that question in people's minds, you can begin to change their beliefs from a firm conviction that the Christian story is true to, well, maybe most of it's true, but. And once you have that but in there, why, of course, why you're on the slippery slope towards, of course, the destruction of your faith.
Right, and it was a project, if you recall, that were from all of these liberal churches a couple of years ago, and I can't remember what it was, when they finally wanted to get together and see if they could all agree upon what the real words of Jesus in the New Testament were, what were fairy tales and what were not. And they could agree on one or two lines out of the whole New Testament.
You're talking about the Jesus seminar?
I think that was it. I couldn't remember. It's late. Sorry. And they go, now, see, this is the problem that you're in. So I always start out by asking the question when somebody does this, well, let me ask a question. When does God stop lying to us? And I like to phrase it that way. Because like you said, if you open up this cork, where does it go down? That's right. Well, when does God stop lying to us? And they always flinch at that one because the concept of God lying doesn't sit well with them. I said, but you see, if he's not telling us the truth here, then maybe he's not telling us the truth about the need for salvation or about the resurrection of Christ or about all of the other things. So when God starts lying to us, when does he stop lying to us?
Well, of course, the biggest problem, of course, is the ultimate one, that we have to accept the scriptures as they are written, not as we would interpret them, but as they're written, and they're really pretty self-evident.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think a lot of the scriptures are pretty, you know, pretty self-evident. I mean, there are parts which require interpretation and understanding. That is the whole point of the part of biblical exegesis. You know, remember out of the Reformation came sola scriptura, because what had happened is at some point the Catholic and Orthodox churches had gone off the rails in terms of biblical understanding of the Catholic, the Roman Church more than the Orthodox. And so Luther said, wait a minute, we've come a long way, we have to get back to the scripture. So they said sola scriptura, but you can't sola scriptura anything. There isn't a single church in the world that believes sola scriptura. Because you must have, at some point or another, somebody to interpret. What do we believe the scriptures to be saying about, say, salvation? About the nature of Christ? How do we read the scriptures? Well, the scripture is the source of faith. I challenge anyone. I've gotten into arguments on this one before. That every church has tradition.
Yeah, then the doctrine is what you're really speaking of, the doctrine of the church.
That's correct. In other words, what do we consider? And that, remember we talked about J. Gresham Machen, back in the 20s and 30s, where he coined the word fundamentalism. Like, okay, we're going to have differences of opinion in certain areas about what the scripture says or how this should be applied. what do we have to be essentially unified as Christians? What are the fundamentals of the faith? That's what he was looking for. It was the very same thing that, say, for example, in the Barman Declaration. The Barman Declaration, which was what the Confessing Church of Germany drew up during the reign of Hitler, so to speak, to say, what is it constitutes a true, authentic Christian church as opposed to this fakery that the Nazis have proposed? Or we could transplant it and say, the fakery of the churches of the communists. Or we have fakery today. Because the new secular humanist, it's not even secular humanist anymore, the new consensus, tolerance, and diversity views the church as a branch office of your local psychological counseling agency. Okay? And as long as the church goes along and acts like a bunch of nice people to rush in when there's a disaster and hold people's hands and tell them when people die that somebody else has gone to a better place and things like that, although they can never tell me what that better place is and how we know there's a better place and what that better place is like, but besides that, they'll do that, then they're okay. Now, as soon as we get back to what we call our fundamentals of what we must believe, which means what? The doctrine of the fall of mankind, the necessity of a Savior, the salvation of Christ by grace through faith, okay, the resurrection of the dead, the second coming of the Lord, the differences between heaven and hell. As soon as we get back to these essences of scriptural exegesis, we are now at odds with their concepts of tolerance and diversity, because those things have impacts and real effects upon our lives. If you do believe those things, then you're going to act and believe in a certain way. If you don't believe those things, you'll believe some other way. But you know what? Something you said about Wormbrand, he said, you know, Romania was riddled by pastors who believe this relativistic blob. Already in Romania, it was there. And he said, when the time of trial came, you know, it was nice to say, oh, I don't believe in hell anymore, or I don't believe in this, and I don't believe we need to do that. But when the rubber hits the road, he said, not one of those relative pastors had anything to stand up and say or anything. He said, how could you ever die for a Jesus Christ you weren't even sure existed, you weren't sure raised from the dead, and weren't sure had saved you from your sins and was coming back? He said, why would you die for that guy when you weren't even sure he did all those things in the back of your mind? So you see, those ideas really do have consequences, which is why Jesus finally said, remember, if you acknowledge me before men, I will acknowledge you before my Father in heaven. If you deny me before men, I will deny you before you. And there it is. There's your martyrios, your witness.
And, of course, you either believe or you don't believe, and there's really nothing in between. And, of course, we have these wonderful four tapes set on, we call it China, and Reverend Millen tells what happens when they were taken and tortured. And, of course, so many of the Catholic fathers, their faith was broken. So many of the liberal Protestants, they went mad, you know, and he was able to maintain at least his focus because, of course, he was schooled in the basic scriptures. And those verses that he'd learned, you know, as a child in Sunday school were the one thing he had to cling to when everything else seemed to be lost. Let's go to Nathan. Nathan, calling from Contra Costa, question or comment?
Hi, good evening, gentlemen. I'd like to just piggyback onto what your guest is saying with just an observation of my years of observing. I believe that there is a concerted effort to turn people into functional deists. And what I mean by that are not philosophical deists, i.e., 18th century deists who believe that the universe was wound up and all the rest, you know, like a clockwork and all the rest of it. No, I think that the forces of darkness know that they're not going to get people to not believe in God. And so what I think the forces of darkness are doing is getting people to believe in God, and yet it doesn't really matter. And that is, and in that they seem to have succeeded.
John,
hopefully I'm wrong, but they seem to have succeeded.
John, what are your thoughts about what Nathan said?
Well, I mean, basically, everything is in, I was going to say, transmogrification right now. Everything is changing, so we are not, the deists of today are indeed not the deists of then. Well, what would the point of that be, Nathan?
Well, I'm not talking about the deists in a philosophical sense, and i.e., I'm not talking about deists in an 18th century sense. I'm talking about more to neutralize people. In other words, if you're the forces of darkness, you're not really interested in politics, you're not interested in in all any of these things so much as you're interested in getting people away from God. And in that sense, you want to get people caught up, in the various distractions of the world.
I would think they're not even interested in getting people away from God as long as you don't define what God is.
Okay? Well,
in other words, when you make your own God, well, you don't have to worry about getting people away from God.
I can go with that, yeah.
Okay, we're going to have to let you go, Nathan. We're out of time. Thanks so very much for calling. And John, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
You know what? I'm still very optimistic. The church has been through rough periods throughout its history all the time. There is another rough period coming for the church in the West, even though it doesn't think so. The bottom line is always to hold to the faith, to hold to the essentials that you need to, so that someday you can hear the words, "Well done, good and faithful servant."
It's very, very well said. God bless you, John. Thank you so much for being with us, and we'll be talking to you later this week.
God bless, Dr. Stan.
Good night. All right, well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed our conversation, simply a free-roaming conversation with our good friend John Loeffler, who I think is one of the cleverest and nicest people that I know, and I'm proud to call him a friend. But you have to understand, we're involved in a spiritual battle that's being fought for the hearts of mankind and the soul of America, and most people don't even know the battle is going on. And, of course, what they want to do is change your attitude towards God, and let's compromise on what we believe in, and let's all get along together. Well, we certainly don't want to be divisive, do we? And I will tell you that Christianity is the most divisive of all religions, because it says we are right, and, of course, we believe, and, of course, there is only one way to God. We have something Gorbachev put up on the Internet. We'll try one of these days to put it onto our website because it's been taken down. But they talk about, of course, the real danger in the world today is fundamentalism and how we are going to have to identify those fundamentalists of whatever religious basis and, of course, begin eliminating them. And that is their word, not mine. They're all going to have to be eliminated. We're dealing with people who hate Christianity, who hate the God of the Bible. And, of course, you hate those of us who espouse it. And it's about time the Christians got involved, understood what the battle is, and prepare for the difficult times that lie ahead. And so until tomorrow, Dr. Stan, good night. Until then, may the Lord be with you.